I'm Amber.
And I'm Becca.
From cranberries
to cows
and everything in between,
this is Forward Farming.
Hey guys, welcome back to Forward Farming. We have our first guest of the new season, and I'm really surprised how this guest came to me because my brother Rusty, and I got a text from him saying, hey, you need to interview my boss. I was like, what are you talking about? So he told me that his boss, Brian Reisinger, just came out with a brand new book. And my brother actually sent me a copy of the book so I could get it ahead of time, ahead of this interview, so I could read through it a little bit before sitting down with him today. So Brian, welcome to the podcast and congratulations on your new book, like hard copy. I've got fingerprint smudges all over it. Land rich, cash poor. Congratulations. This is a really amazing book, not only for Wisconsin agriculture, but agriculture as a whole. So congratulations and welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. There's nothing better than a well-read book. So I take that as a compliment, if nothing else.
Yeah, my toddler, he sees a tractor on here and he's always grabbing at it and losing my place, but that's okay. It's well-loved in this family already.
We will accept readers of all ages and backgrounds.
So tell me a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your upbringing, where you're from, what you do now, your social security number. Give me all the details that you have.
You got it. I don't know if there's so much in the bank account at all, but whatever I've got. So I grew up in Southwest Wisconsin, Sauk County, Driftless area. So you and a lot of your listeners, of course, know all about that, but I'm in the southern part of that. And we grew up dairy farming. And we are fourth generation, counting my sister, who's taken over from my dad. And we have what I'd like to think is a proud history. We're certainly proud of it. I know that's true of folks all over dairy country and cranberry country in the state of Wisconsin, but it's also true all across the country. And what I grew up with was knowing that our way of life was one that was disappearing. You know, you see the number of kids that are from a farm, the number of hands that go up in class getting less and less each year, stuff like that. So you always kind of know you're lucky to grow up on a farm. It's such an amazing, valuable place in terms of the values, the circle of life, the hard work that you learn, working alongside your family, living close to the land, living close to animals, all that stuff. You know, it's special. And I realized it was maybe even more special because it was becoming more rare. What I didn't know was why. And as I got older and as I got into first business journalism and then public policy, because I had a little bit more talent for words than I did cattle and crops. It's my dad and sister who have those talents more so. They'll still throw me in a tractor now and then. And I help out on the business side and I help out in the field in the farmyard when I'm able. But I took an off-farm job where I began to see and understand what was going on in our economy. And I realized nobody had ever told this story of why is it that our farms are disappearing? What's good? What's challenging about agriculture today? What does it say about our country? What does it say about our food supply? Why should people care? And I found that there are really compelling answers to all that as I dug into trying to figure this out about 2 years ago. But as I say, in some ways, I felt like the story was with us from the beginning, you know?
Yeah, definitely. As soon as I started reading your book, it was kind of like a gut punch. You know, you had just kind of that reaction. And I hope people that aren't farmers are kind of getting that reaction too of like, this is happening. This has been happening for a long time, and farms are disappearing at a rapid rate, and farmers are struggling now more than ever. And especially the way that you, I don't want to give away too much about the book, but the little snippet that you had when you talked about your dad when he sold off his cows, and I was just like, it punches you right in the gut, and so many people I'm sure can relate to that. So, kind of talk to me about how you started this process of writing this book, what really motivated you to start writing and kind of follow through and tell the story the way that you did.
Yeah, happy to. And what I'll say first is I think your observations are absolutely right. I think that people who have lived this might be surprised to know the reasons, or it's a process to fully face it because we know what's going on, but we also know there's amazing things going on in agriculture. And so there's a desire to kind of keep going and moving forward, and we're going to do that. But facing also the disappearance and what it means is something that's good for people who grow up in it to do, because we have to look at the challenges to understand the solutions and the opportunities for the future. At the same time, people who are outside of farming way of life and people who at any dinner table all across the country need to know about this because it affects our food. So I appreciate what you're saying. As far as getting into this, It really started for me with the family stories. It was important for me to, yes, do historical research to understand what drove this issue. It was important to do research on what is the impact in terms of on food prices and on our food supply and other things. But where it really started and where it ends and winds all throughout for me is my family. And so I had heard stories. Every farm family has these incredible stories over the generations. I'd heard stories about my great grandpa and my grandpa. And, you know, although I got serious about this book project about 2 years ago, I had known for a long time I wanted to do something. I wanted to write something about my roots. So fortunately, for about the past decade, I had been talking to people going all the way back to my grandpa's generation. Unfortunately, my great-grandparents and their generation, too many of them were gone for me to be able to talk to them firsthand. But I talked to their children and I talked to all the generations on down through. So I had hours and hours and hours of archived interviews that just were all these incredible family stories. So that's where it started for me. And as I went along, for example, you know, when my great-grandparents were here, they had a son who was crippled in the fields under horses. And it was this horrible, heartrending story. But it was also this amazing story about how he survived that, went on to become a successful farmer and small businessman for the rest of his life, walking on an artificial leg. It's incredible what people lived through. All kinds of things all throughout our family's history. My grandpa growing up in poverty during the Great Depression and climbing in the middle class by the 1940s and 50s. You know, my parents surviving the farm crisis, and which there was a drought on top of it in the years in advance of that in southern Wisconsin. All these things. I realized that as I was pulling out the stories that I thought were most compelling for readers, I realized that those stories lined up with things that I was finding when I was researching our broader economy and history. And so what I decided was for each era from the early 1900s through the 2020s, I was going to find what's that hidden piece of history? What is that hidden story that we don't know that's beneath the surface of each era that has driven the disappearance of our farms? And what I was so lucky to find as I did that is that each of those hidden histories lined up with something our family was dealing with. You know, when, just as an example, in the Great Depression, when that hit in Black Thursday in 1929, it hit the whole country. Well, the truth was that families like yours and mine were already facing an agricultural depression 10 years before that. History forgot that. So telling that story and talking about my grandpa for those first two decades of his life growing up in economic depression, it lined up in a way that I could have never planned. And it was just such an amazing thing. And I think it just speaks to the power of what farm families live through, you know?
Yeah. And it was really interesting to read a book, the way that you kind of compiled everything together, going decade by decade, going through every struggle during the decade, and then having a personal story tie into it. I'm not a huge nonfiction reader, but it made it a little bit easier to digest and understand, you know, all those numbers. I'm not a number person. So seeing all those statistics, it was just like, oh my goodness. But then having a story that's a little bit more relatable to me to go along with it, it made it like, it just added another depth that I've never really read anything like that before. So that was really cool. I'm really glad that you wrote it that way. That was really cool. After doing all that research on your family, were there any stories that you really wish that you could have put in the book that maybe just didn't make sense in the timeline, or anything that really stuck out to you that you hadn't heard before?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, there are so many. One story that I really find incredible from my parents that I got a chance to reference, but I didn't get a chance to tell, was early on when they were in their first year of marriage, they actually had their dairy herd come down with mastitis. And for those who didn't grow up in dairy, that's a very serious thing. That's essentially an infection that can sicken the cows, it can spoil the milk. And what it can mean is that you've got a herd that is no good. I mean, you know, you might have to sell that herd at a significant discount from what you got it for, and might not have the money to rebuild the herd after that. If you can hold on to the herd, you might have to throw out a ton of milk, dump a ton of milk, lose all kinds of income, and really put the farm in a very difficult position. It turned out to be about a third of the herd that was affected by this. And this was in their first year of marriage. And it was a year after a drought. And I do tell the drought story in the book. And I talk about that drought story and how that led into the farm crisis. But I only barely got to reference the mastitis issue, because that was something that could have really wiped them out. Mm-hmm. And they did come through it. They came through it because of some hard work and some changes in their practices. They discovered a lot. And also they did something that is harder and harder for farms to do these days, which is they were able to install a new technology. They financed through a dairy supply company a pipeline. And so the pipeline would take the milk from the cows straight to the bulk tank in the milk house, rather than the old days. Anybody who's milked when they were really young, or years ago, would carry the milk canisters to a step saver and pour it into a bigger bucket. And there was it was much more work intensive. So they were able to install that pipeline, change and improve sanitation practices, and able to cure their herd of that. But, you know, it was a really close call. And it also touches on something that I do talk about more in the book, which is the way the role technology plays, where we have less and less technology these days that can work for farms of all sizes and all types. We call it scale neutral. It used to be that there's a lot of that kind of technology. So farms, whether it's dairy or cranberry or whatever, farms of all sizes and types had all kinds of technology and innovation and advancement that they could be part of to find new opportunities or cheaper ways to do things. That's something that has gotten harder and harder for many farms to do because we don't have that kind of discovery going on anymore. So like that pipeline was one of the last real innovations that a farm our size could do. And after that, you know, you had to make bigger, more expensive changes if you wanted to improve your operation because of the way that our technology in this country changed. So I just admired my parents' resilience. And I just thought, I can't imagine, you know, their first year of marriage and they're going to head into the farm crisis. And here they are with a third of their herd sick and they made it through, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty incredible and speaks a lot about the character of both of your parents, I think. It always surprises me that even with all the technology advances throughout history, it's always kind of just the same problems for farmers year in and year out. And it's so hard. Everything that should be under control with any other job is just completely out of control with the farmers, from the price of their products to weather to just random accidents happening. You're never going to meet a more resilient person than a farmer, I think. And when I was in high school and playing sports, coaches would always love to hear that you're a farm kid because, like, we know you're going to follow directions and we know that you're going to work harder usually than most of the other athletes. So it was, I think everybody knows just a little bit how resilient farmers can be. But I always like to ask this question to folks who have multi-generation history on a farm, is if you could go back and talk to your great-grandfather, or if you could have him sitting across from you today, what would you like to ask him? Or maybe would you want to go show him where your farm is at today and show him the technology advances? What do you think would be the first thing you'd like to talk to him about?
Oh my goodness. You know, that's incredible. That's such an amazing question to ask. And it's one I wasn't prepared for, which is a good thing.
Surprise.
They're like, oh, that was a bad like, he sounded dumbfounded. Such a good question. You know, I think I would want to ask him what he would hope for us now. And the reason I say that is, it might sound like a really simple thing to ask, but, you know, farm families make a lot of assumptions about what's expected of them, you know, and he is someone who created a lot of that expectation, maybe unintentionally, but he came over from, you know, pre-World War I Europe. He left Bavaria because he didn't want to fight in World War I on the German side. He wanted to come to America and make a better life for himself. So he had been in the military. He had a treacherous journey to get here. When he got here, it was dirt poor subsistence farming. He survived that to be able to get us in a place where we had a farm that could survive the Great Depression, right? And then his son, my grandpa, took over, feeling like he kind of had to. And then his son, my dad, took over, feeling like he kind of had to. Now, in my dad's case, he loved it. It was down in his blood and his bones. And my dad is one of those people who they would, you know, that's his calling. That's what people would say. And he would say that too. I was fourth generation, eldest son. I was the first in four generations to not take over. I'm grateful that my sister's taken over. And as I said, I'm still involved. And obviously I'm working to tell our story, but I carried that around for a long time. I carried a lot of guilt. I carried a lot of sense of that I'd let people down for a long time. And so talking to him, and just now that he would be able to see what has happened over the generation, I'd love to know just what would he want for us? Because the assumption is that, you know, he would want all of us to put our heads down and overcome what we overcame, because damn it, he did harder things than we ever did. And there might be some truth to that, but I also think that he'd be amazed to see what's happened over the generations. And I would just love to hear his answer to that question to understand, because I also know that at the end of the day, each farm family just wants the next generation to be able to persist. And maybe they want it in the way that they did it, or maybe it turns out in a way that's completely different. But every time I see a farm make it to the next generation, the old generation has a hard time letting go, but then they're so grateful and gracious and proud when they see the next generation take root. So I would just love to hear what he thinks of all this, because I think we all assume that he'd say, put your head down and try harder. And he probably would say some of that. But I'd love to know what else he would say, because it's an incredible legacy that he helped create, you know?
Yeah, isn't it amazing how the first generation just sets a bar for what the path of your family is going to take, and you look back on it, and it's just incredible to see just how little bits from every generation just kind of trickle down, and it just gets instilled in your blood. Like I always tell people, my blood is extra red because of how rich our history is here, and it's just amazing to kind of feel that closeness because of the land that you all shared, and how you all try to leave it a better place than when you first started. So how is a generational change going for your family between your dad and your sister? I know what it's like here, but how is it like on your family's farm? Is that a smooth transition? Was your dad excited? Did they get along well? How is that transition going?
I appreciate that question from a fellow farm family. It's going really, really well. But my sister likes to say, you know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows, you know.
Right.
And it's tough because these are serious things. You know, I was talking to Pam Yonke, the fabulous farm babe with the Midwest Farm Report, who I think is one of the most credible people on these issues. And she says, I'm sure these things go on in boardrooms of businesses, but this is around the family kitchen table, you know. Mm-hmm. And we talked to her in the book, and I've talked to her at other times about this. And it's just so hard because it's a real business. It's a family business. And no matter how big the farm is, it's a small business in a big world at the end of the day. And there's so much emotion wrapped up in it, you know? And what I am proud to say is that the transition is going well, but like any family, we have our challenges. And the reason it's going well is because we really focus on communicating. And, you know, we have family meetings where we get together and we talk each month. And my sister is coming into her own as the manager of the farm, making recommendations of what we need to be doing, guiding us through some transitions. And my dad, as a person who led the farm through the farm crisis and all of these things, is learning to let go while giving her the guidance and support she needs. And those are hard balances to do.
Very much.
There's one little story that exemplifies it. So we sold our dairy herd in spring of 2021. And like you said, that's hard. That's like a death in the family, you know, but we didn't want it to be the death of the farm or death of our way of life. So what we were doing is we were selling the herd because the changes we would have had to make to keep milking were just the kind that were too expensive. And we wanted to make a change. So we're pursuing my sister's plan that she and I worked on together. They were her ideas, and we developed them and worked with my dad on them to instead raise custom heifers for other dairy herds, to raise beef for consumers, and to also cash crop and diversify what we were growing. And it's working. And we're hitting the income targets my sister laid out, and we're figuring out how to get the whole farm aligned with that. And we're making this multi-year transition, and it's working. But boy, was it hard, you know, and getting through that transition of my dad being ready to sell the cows and what to do with our facilities instead. You know, there's a lot of internal family, I'll call them discussions, but that might be a little bit of a euphemism, because sometimes there are a little bit of battles, you know, and that's natural. And that happens with every generation where it's hard to let go. And it's hard for every generation that's coming up to step up too. And you find that balance as you go, but it doesn't come easy, you know?
Right. There's a lot of pride involved in all generations. And when pride gets involved in discussions, it turns heated very quickly. And that's a blessing and a curse. It's great to have that much emotion tied to what you're doing and your livelihood. But at the same time, you know, you have to go home and celebrate a birthday, you know, right after this argument, or you have to go home and like go to church afterwards. It's like you have to have a face for each side of the family that you're dealing with. Like you need to have that business side and then immediately flip a switch and forget everything and go home and be a family again. And that's a really hard fine line to navigate sometimes. So I'm really glad at the end of your book, you did a quick little page on mental health, because I think that's something that farmers really need to be aware of and know that that is an option, especially in today's world. So there are crisis numbers available in your book that I really appreciate that you included in there. And if you guys need that, we'll link that in the show notes below too, because we can never reiterate enough how important mental health is inside farming and outside of farming. So make sure you guys check that out if you or someone you know needs help, because everyone could use it every once in a while. One more big question about your book before we get into some fun questions. What is kind of the biggest takeaway that you hope readers get from reading your story?
I hope that the biggest thing people take away is that we have to address these issues because of our food supply, but also because when we're losing the farms that feed us, we're kind of losing a part of ourselves, you know? And farm families know a lot of that stuff, but we don't necessarily as farm families like to necessarily speak up, to your point about mental health, but also to your point about just discussions about the direction of the country and what's going on. You know, farm families tend to put their heads down and get the work done, you know? And we do need to speak up about it. And we do need to have people out there who live in New York or Chicago or anywhere else to understand that, hey, you know, when we continue to have farms disappearing and we continue to have fewer and fewer distribution chains for our food to get from the farm gate to the dinner table, you know, it's going to cause challenges during times like COVID when that supply chain shuts down, or it's going to cause higher prices that have nothing to do with the farmer. You know, the farmer isn't getting more money in their pocket when you got higher prices. There's a lot of other things at play, you know, and if people want to have affordable food and food that's available and a lot of choices to them long term, we have to have a healthy farm sector. And so I just hope that people will understand that and see that. And for those people who live outside of, you know, farming areas and don't know that, I hope they do, because it can build support for us to make the kinds of changes we need to help more farms make in the future. And for those farm families that knew that but haven't been talking about it, I hope it encourages more farm families to share their stories, because I think it's something that amazes people when they hear it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That's, I mean, people need food to survive, and yet there's so much misinformation about there about where their food is coming from, or even just a farmer behind their food as well. I think this does a great job kind of explaining the history and really giving that true American farmer feeling. So love this book. I'll link your website so folks can go buy this. But where can people find your book?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, people can find it a variety of places. First and easiest for many people is Amazon or anywhere else you buy books online. A lot of people buy them on Amazon, and there's various other places, but also in your local bookstore. And a lot of people like to support their local bookstores, which I love and appreciate myself personally. So if you buy on Amazon or anywhere else, jump on there, you can find it. But also it's in bookstores nationwide. Stop by or call your local bookstore. They ought to have it. If they don't, they can get it for you. And so there's a lot of ways to get it. And I hope plenty of people will pick it up and help, you know, raise awareness about this issue more importantly.
Definitely. Well, congratulations. Job well done. But before I let you go, we always like to do a few rapid fire questions that I have honestly not thought about until this very second. So are you ready? You ready for some random rapid questions?
As ready as I'm going to be. I love that.
Okay. Are you a big fan of Quick Trip?
Yes.
So my co-host Becca and I, we have this feud going on. Do you buy chocolate milk from Quick Trip? And if so, do you prefer brown cap or green cap chocolate milk? And this is a big question.
That's crucial. I'm going to be honest. I don't know if I'm going to fit the box as you guys want. I buy the strawberry milk. Really good. So I think that's all pink cap.
It is.
But I don't know where I'm falling on this, but I have to say that when I do buy chocolate milk, I really prefer the brown cap. And I don't know whose side that puts me on, but it just feels
the
more
wrong natural. Side.
The wrong side.
The wrong side. We got a bunch of friends together and we did a blind taste test comparison. And we actually had more people on the green cap side than the brown cap, I was kind of surprised. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm outgunned on that one. I had no idea. You know, I've been wrong before. So
it's fine. I'll give it to you this time. So if you're at a cookout, a tailgate, are you going to go for a brat or are you going to go for the hot dog?
Brat every time, because you got a guarantee of some level of quality there. You know, I mean, hot dogs, like, I love a hot dog, but it really kind of depends who's buying and how they're preparing it. A brat, usually, you know, you got some level of assurance of quality, in my opinion.
Yeah, with the hot dogs, you could get the Snappy skin, or you could just get an Oscar Mayer. Or worst of all, you could get like a cheddar wurst, which is kind of like
wishing you had
a regular Long John, but instead you got like one of those frosting filled ones.
I just don't want to be surprised in those instances. People don't screw around with brats. It's just like, you know, it's it's, you know what you're going to get. So I like that predictability of the broad, I guess.
Sticking with the Wisconsin theme, are you going to go for squeaky or fried cheese curds?
Oh, squeaky. Yeah. Squeaky.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, I love fried cheese curds. And I also like, I'm very particular about when and how I'll eat my cheese, but squeaky cheese curds, man, that's like, I just grew up with that, you know, and my mom would have those, and it's kind of like drinking milk straight from the bulk tank, which is sort of like you grew up with that. So it's got a special something to it. So.
Okay. Okay. What is your favorite Wisconsin festival? Are you a Summerfest? Are you an Oktoberfest kind of guy? What's your jam?
You know what? This is going to be a little off the beaten path, but I got to say the Plain 3-Day Festival down in Plain, Wisconsin in Sauk County. This is like the whole town like is blocked off, and it's not just like one day. Like think about any, community festival. It's 3 days. It's called the 3-Day. So like it's literally just every day there's like softball and cookouts going on and beer tents at night and concerts. And we just do it for 3 days because one wouldn't be enough. So
right.
For me, if I can be free and able to make it to the 3-Day for at least one day, but better yet three, that's the best festival to me.
Okay. Have you been to the Warren's Cranberry Festival?
No, but that sounds like something I need to be at.
You should. Every last full weekend in September. So if you're free, come on up and you can come visit.
That is good to know. That is good to know. I'll have to check that out.
Okay. One last final question, then I'll let you go. What is your favorite blend? Since you know Rusty, what's your favorite blend of Ocean Spray juice?
Amazing. So I don't know where this puts me on the win-lose spectrum, but like I like straight up cranberry juice. I don't like it sweetened. I like just like the regular.
The pure?
Yeah, the pure, like the uncut, like, you know, like whiskey neat kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like I've always loved, I'll also like just eat raw cranberries. Like I love that. And I feel like I'm drinking something that's like, you know, improving my life. Like I'm going to live, like it's like the opposite of a cigarette, you know, like this is ending a few years to your life when you drink that, in my opinion. So I like that. I know there's all kinds of great blends and cocktails and stuff, but I'll take the straight stuff.
I love that answer. Puts a little hair on your chest in the morning.
Exactly. That's what my dad is.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Brian, so much for hopping on here today. Again, I will link your book, Land Rich Cash Poor, in our show notes and where you can go and buy that right away. Definitely check that out because I learned so much from it. And just your family's story is just incredible and definitely something that you should be proud of. And I'm sure your family is so glad that you were able to sit down and put that all together for future generations to go back and read on to, because that's really special and something that a lot of people don't really get to know is their family history and that kind of the depth. So congratulations. This was great. And it was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. I love what you and Becca do as far as telling these kinds of stories and getting the word out there about agriculture and speaking up for the farming community. It's so great. And so it's an honor to be here. And I appreciate being able to come here and talk these issues about you guys. So.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening, you guys. And if you're not following us already, go give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram over at Forward Farming Podcast. You can check this interview out on YouTube and catch up on some of our old interviews, or you can listen wherever you get your daily podcasts at. So thank you guys again, and we'll see you next time.